sit back, relax, and take a ride with us on the Gunblog Variety Cast, episode 18. I'm your host, Sean, from NC Gunblog, and with me today is Adam from Guns, Cars, Tech Blog. How are you doing, Adam?
The baby slept for 7 hours in a row.
In a row! All right.
So he'll probably sleep 3 hours tonight. Yeah, whatever.
Oh, cool. So a little housekeeping today. I have noticed that on your iDevice, if you are listening to this show in iTunes, if you just punch the album cover, that's the stars and blue and red stuff, if you push that, it'll display the show notes for you. And all of the links on the show notes are live. You can just punch the links, go straight to it, and read it. It's pretty awesome.
Neat.
Now we're going to start with a tactical dog and fitness report. 28.7 dog walking miles this week. And I spent the week with my parents for my parents' 50th anniversary. Happy anniversary, Mom and Dad. 50
yeah.
years.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. I remember their 25th anniversary. I just graduated from high school. They went to Hawaii. This year, it was both of their sons were in the same house at the same time, so that was kind of a double-edged sword there, I think. And I found out if I want a tired dog, all I need to do is get another dog that might possibly want one of Dice's Frisbees, and then throw the Frisbee down the hill, and Dice's will run and get the Frisbee, and then she'll run back and give me the Frisbee because, oh, you've got another Frisbee, and you might throw that, and the other dog might get it. Oh, no!
Yes.
She'd rather run herself to death than let another dog get her Frisbee.
Probably, yes. Our dogs really like to have a job, and her job is getting that Frisbee. She doesn't want anybody else to do her job.
Yeah, that's probably true. And I've been doing my dry fire drills for IDPA in my quest for sharpshooter. It's a lot more tiring than I'd expected, even though it's 15 minutes total.
So what kind of dry fire drills are you doing?
Well, I spent the day with Ben from Triangle Tactical. He designed three drills for me. It was take 3 minutes and draw from concealment to an IDPA. It's a 1/3 size IDPA target that I've got taped to the door.
Mm-hmm.
Draw from concealment, aim, and pull the trigger on that target. And do that for 3 minutes. Don't do it under a time pressure, but you know, like you don't have like a par timer. Have you ever used a timer, like a shot timer? You can set it so that it gives you like a second and a half and it beeps again.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Higher end dry fire, that's what you do. But for this, it was, you know, just do it a bunch of times. And I found that, yeah, you know what? If you just do it a whole bunch of times, you get better at it.
Interesting.
Surprising. Yeah. So it's 3 minutes of draw to a single target, fire a single shot. And of course, it's dry fire, so it's pull the trigger. Don't fire a real shot in your house.
Yes.
The second drill is a reload drill. You start with an empty gun, no magazine in it, with the striker set. So you could pull the trigger if you want. Start pointing at the target and then turn the gun, push the mag drop button, even though there's no mag in it, and pull your magazine out of your mag carrier, insert the magazine, come back to the target, aim, and pull the trigger.
Okay.
And then reset and do it again and again and again. You do that for 4 minutes. And then the third drill is working either side of a bit of cover. So you draw with a magazine in, you draw, address, you've got three targets, you shoot your targets on one side of the barrier, two shots, drop the magazine, reload with a new magazine, go to the other side of the cover, and fire two shots on the same three targets.
Now, in that scenario, since you're dry firing, you don't have a live striker.
I have an XD, and you'd be surprised how the trigger really still works. It doesn't have the snap to it, and it would be nice if I still had that. But the fact that you can pull the trigger each time, it simulates the shots. It's really, Glocks don't do that. Glocks have a flat dead trigger.
Right, right.
But XD doesn't.
Yeah, I think my M&P, I could probably do that too, but my
Glock would
be right out.
I believe, yeah, the M&P has a live-ish trigger.
Yeah.
Still. So what about you and your tactical dog?
Man, poor tactical dog. She's so neglected. On days that I'm not running, I take her on extra long-ish walks. But every day for the last week, week and a half that I've tried to do that, as I open up the front door, the baby starts screaming. And so I can't leave for too terribly long. I can't, you know, go on a half hour walk with the dog while the baby's screaming. So we just kind of go outside. But she's so pitiful. I mean, she really is. And I do feel kind of bad that she's not getting the attention that she used to get, but it's temporary. Plus, it's, you know, 30 degrees outside. She doesn't want to really stay out there very long anyway.
Yeah, and plus she's the dog. She's the bottom of the totem pole. Right, even she knows that.
Yeah, I think she's starting to figure that out. She's not happy. Not happy at all.
Yeah, maybe now, but let somebody put their hands on that baby and see what happens to him.
Yeah.
And now it's time for that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Aaron Paulette. Aaron points out that people in Florida shouldn't prepare for earthquakes any more than people in California should prepare for hurricanes. Aaron, when we talk about preps, you keep talking about your bug out bag this and your bug out bag that. I don't have a bug out bag. I don't really see the need for one. Why do you have a bug out bag?
I have a bug out bag because I live in Florida and there is a tendency for large, nasty things on an environmental scale to come at me, such as hurricanes and statewide forest fires. And that's not the kind of thing I can really bunker down against. So my first priority for survival is to get out. Now, counterexample, Adam lives in Tennessee. He's not going to have to worry about a hurricane coming in and wiping out his house. And so I would imagine that his priorities are more for bunkering in for environmental things like a big snowstorm that would knock out power for a week.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
So a bug out bag makes more sense for me. It might not make sense for you. And really, that's the entire point of this particular segment. The important thing about prepping is that you need to identify which disasters are more likely to affect you and then concentrate on those from the most likely to the least likely. Because if you're not careful, prepping as a hobby or as a lifestyle can unfortunately lead to a pathology. And this is one reason why I just rail against the program Doomsday Preppers. Because it makes for good television, they like to focus on these people who are obsessed, and they don't have what I would consider to be a healthy mindset. They are in service to their preps are not in service to them. And that is really not a healthy thing. So my advice is that you concentrate on one disaster, and you prepare for that as much as possible, and then you go to the next one until you get into the very small probability. You're far more likely to suffer a house fire than you are to be EMP'd or the victim of a terror attack. And you're likeliest of all to lose a job or suffer from an unexpected expense. And financial preparedness is actually the most important prep of all.
Longtime readers of my blog will know that I'm pretty big on this. I'm a huge Dave Ramsey guy. If you don't know who Dave Ramsey is, just Google Dave Ramsey. But basically, he is a financial guru. He's the debt-free guy, right? So get out of debt, get an emergency fund, and that's basically what he says. Now, I've been listening to Dave Ramsey for about 10 years. I've been debt-free for about 7 now. And one of the things that he preaches is a 3 to 6 months of emergency fund. So 3 to 6 months of expenses, not necessarily income, but your expenses. And that served us pretty well. You know, we just had a baby. My wife was on maternity leave. She was unpaid for that. And I went on a kind of a weird leave of absence thing. And my payroll got messed up and they only paid me for 3 days in November. My wife didn't get paid at all. And I want y'all to think, if your household income got dropped to basically 5%, could you make it through that next month with the holidays coming up? So for us, it wasn't such a big deal because we had this 6 month of emergency fund. It's just kind of annoying. I mean, it all got worked out, right? So, I mean, it was only a few days for them to actually rectify my pay. But I have been 12, 13 years ago, that would have been really bad for me.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, Aaron, so what you're saying here is make a list of the things that are likely to happen, from lose my job to meteor strike. and really concentrate on the most likely things to happen.
Yes, that, and also to echo what Adam said, don't put yourself into debt with your preps. There are some people who feel they absolutely have to have an underground bunker and they go into debt because those things are crazy expensive. Okay, you do that, and then you lose your job, and if you can't pay your mortgage, you lose the house, and then guess what? You lose that bunker prep in your backyard. So you have actually made things worse for yourself, that you're not better at all. There is a blogger called Bob S. of Three Boxes of BS, and he's got a great blog post about how financial prepping really saved his bacon when there was a problem with, I believe it was an automated draft for medical insurance.
Yeah, I read that story, and, you know, that could happen to any of us. I mean, it's just a simple bank error that would have totally sunk him had he not been prepared. You know, it's not the sort of thing you can just recover from losing $2,500, you know, when two drafts is $2,500. And he's in serious trouble.
Mm-hmm. And finally, I want to encourage preppers, don't be afraid to take a break from prepping for a time if you need to. If you need to detox from the worry, if you feel like prepping is all you think about, just take a break. The beauty of preps is that they stick around. They will not go away if you stop thinking about them for a week. So take however long you need to get your head straight, and then you can come at it with a fresh perspective.
Excellent, Aaron. So preps are supposed to give you peace of mind, not to drive you paranoid.
Exactly, Sean.
All right, Aaron. It's good to talk to you. See you again next week.
See you next week.
If you'd like to read more from Aaron, check out her personal blog at lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com. Felons behaving badly. Man starved dog to death on purpose. Wake deputies charge. Dateline Garner. My town.
Oh, nice.
A man who lived near Garner faces a felony charge of intentionally starving a dog to death last month by leaving it outside on a chain without food, water, or shelter. Wake County Sheriff's deputies arrested suspect, 52, after stopping him on U.S. 70 near Rainer Road Saturday evening. In an arrest warrant, deputies charged that between October 14 and 17, suspect intentionally deprived a dog of, quote, necessary sustenance, unquote, by leaving it on a 7-foot chain outside without food, water, shelter, and the dog starved to death. Deputies did not say how old the dog was or list its breed. Suspect was listed on the arrest warrant as living at 4528 Bushy Branch Drive, southeast of Garner. He gave the booking officer of the Wake County Detention Center an address of 2378 NC-123 in Hookerton in Greene County.
Aaron says, stop by and say hi, with a baseball bat.
Suspect was in custody on $15,000 bail and was scheduled for a court appearance. So what kind of person do you figure would intentionally deprive a dog of necessary sustenance?
A school teacher.
School teacher.
School teacher.
Concealed handgun permit holder.
Yes.
Some sort of horrible, nasty, rotten, ordinary citizen, right?
Yes. Totally, completely ordinary person.
Yeah. Other misdemeanor, 11-684 misdemeanor. Forgery, 8-1489, felon class I. Forgery, 8-1489 again, felon class I. Uttering forged paper, 8-1489, same day, felon class I. Larceny over $200, 311.91, felon class H. Larceny of a motor vehicle, 311.91, felon class H. Receiving stolen goods, 315.91, felon class H. Receiving stolen goods, 322.91, misdemeanor. Receiving stolen vehicle, 1.18.92, felon class I. Speeding from police, 8.21.92, misdemeanor. Obtained property by false coins tokens, 5.24.96, felon class H. Assault on a female, 7.31.98. Misdemeanor class A1, common law uttering attempted, 826.10, misdemeanor class 1, common law forgery, 827.2010, misdemeanor class 1. The guy is a criminal, has been a criminal since I was in high school.
Nice. So, good guy.
Yeah, a wonderful human being.
Yeah.
Anybody who would treat a dog like that, how's he going to treat a person? Clearly, we know how he's going to treat a person. He's going to steal from them, take their stuff, assault them. If you're female, I guess.
Yeah.
So, real decent human being. The one violent crime is assault on a female and assault on a dog, I guess.
Yeah.
We see how he views the world. He picks on the people smaller than him. Next up, we have foreign policy for grown-ups. Nikki talks about torture. And given the last guy, I have her first candidate. Nikki, the Democrats in the Senate released their torture report, mostly as a way to distract from the Gruber testimony about Obamacare. But are there real-world consequences to this report? Torture is banned by international convention, but what is torture?
There are three things we actually need to consider when we talk about torture. So first of all, like you asked, what is it? Also, is it effective? Does it work? Is it worth it? And what are the external costs? Again, is it worth what we're doing? Are the costs and benefits balancing out? The first thing I want to talk about is what it is. So the widest definition of torture comes from the United Nations. The Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment. Short is UNCAT. The UN defines torture as any act by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted on a person for such purposes as obtaining from him or a third person information or confession. The definition goes on and on and on. By this definition, you know, emotional anguish, cruel inhuman punishment, one could say, sure, what we did to those terrorists was torture. But is it really? We saw waterboarding, we saw stress positions, we saw a lot of very uncomfortable stuff, and it was perpetrated against not formal soldiers, not an army from another state, but from terrorists, from basically enemy combatants. So defining this torture, you know, we may define it as such under the UN Convention, but on the other hand, well, if we were legally to define it, is it torture? Probably not. John McCain would actually disagree with you on this. He's one of the biggest, most outspoken critics of torture. He was, in fact, very much tortured in Vietnam. I mean, I'm not talking a little water on his face. I'm talking broken bones and ropes and chains and dysentery and all kinds of stuff. The question becomes, does torture work? Well, John McCain, who's an outspoken opponent of torture, guess what? It worked on him. In fact, in Vietnam, he gave in and he made an anti-American propaganda speech in Vietnam. Okay, so torture did in fact achieve what the Vietnamese wanted to achieve, which is to force this American POW to give in and make anti-American propaganda. No, he's not proud of it. He couldn't take it anymore. And he absolutely gave in. So in that case, it was actually effective. The problem with this torture report that just came out is that it never explored whether anything was effective. We saw a lot of people on the news talking about, you know, we're self-proclaimed experts and we know that torture didn't yield any kind of actionable intelligence. The Senate panel interviewed not one single expert from the CIA. It didn't research the results. And the report was, in fact, biased. As you mentioned in the beginning, part of it was to detract from the attention of the Gruber testimony. And also, you know, they're just being vindictive. It's a scorched earth strategy to blame one party or another for torture. Frankly, they experienced some pretty big losses in November, and this was nothing new. This was nothing different. This is nothing they didn't know about. It was simply a strategy to get even. So really, we can't know what was effective and what wasn't, because a lot of that stuff is, in fact, still classified. In order to have done that research, they would have to have had some due diligence, and I don't think they did. So what are the external costs? There are costs to the government's relationship with its people. This is something that a lot of people may not have known about. They don't want to give the government that kind of authority. They were shocked. There's a lot of libertarian folks out there who are absolutely incensed by this. They feel this is a violation of their trust in government, and they don't have a whole lot of trust in government to begin with. So do we want to give the government that kind of power? If we allow it to torture one individual, what what's going to stop these people from, you know, making excuses and torturing others? And then there are external costs. There are foreign policy costs. How does all of this, all of these revelations, how do they affect our relationships with other nations? We have a certain reputation as being this moral, ethical country, a country that people look up to. Will our allies want to work with us? How will they cooperate with us if we're doing, you know, a joint mission? How are our relationships with our military allies going to be? How is it going to affect diplomatic relations between nations? Are nations really going to look at us as an example? All of these things we have to take into consideration. The torture question, aside from whether or not this was torture, whether or not definitionally it was legal or it falls under the definition of torture, that's just one facet of this really, really complex problem. The problem really becomes, what does it affect? What kind of information did we get? Was it worth it? And how are our foreign relations affected by these revelations?
That seems like a pretty good way to look at it. A, is it legal? B, does it work? And C, does it cost us more than the benefit that we gain?
And that's something that remains to be seen, really.
All right, Nikki, it was good to talk to you. See you again next week.
You bet. Take care.
Nikki blogs at thelibertyzone.com. Strange laws. What did you find for us this week, Adam?
So I remembered this one from when I went to Arkansas in 2010 to visit a couple of friends of mine. So as a carry permit holder, you know, when you travel from state to state, you have to not only find out where your permits are good, if you have multiple permits, for reciprocity, so you don't get arrested for carrying a handgun, you also have to figure out where you can't carry a handgun. You know, some states you can't carry them in churches, some states you can't carry them in places that serve alcohol. But here in Arkansas, you have a kind of a strange notification requirement. It's Arkansas Code Title 5, Subtitle 6, Chapter 73, Subchapter 3, Handguns Prohibited Places. So it's 573-306. No license to carry a concealed handgun issued pursuant to this subchapter authorizes any person to carry a concealed handgun into, and then here we get subsection D, which is the interesting place, any licensee entering a private home shall notify the occupant that that licensee is carrying a concealed handgun. So what happened was, my fraternity brother, who I was going to see, as soon as I walked in his door, I said, oh, I had to say, by the way, Arkansas state law requires me to notify you that I've got a gun. And he goes, no shit.
So this really wasn't a surprise to him, I guess.
No, it wasn't really a surprise to anybody.
Well, if I ever have to visit anybody in Arkansas, I will make sure to let them know immediately that I'm carrying a gun.
Yeah. You know, I kind of want to know where I want to see the debate that was going on in, like, subcommittee where they had to add that.
I really think that's one of those, let's put this poison pill in and maybe we'll get people not want to carry.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
I don't know. What do you mean I have to tell my mother-in-law that I've got a gun?
Well, sometimes I think that the internet is just a more efficient way to spread rumors. Miguel points out that in addition to being a fantastic rumor mill, the internet allows us direct access to primary sources, and we should use them. Miguel, something's really got your goat today. You're really pissed off about something. What's going on?
Having so much information available, we have the internet. Why people have to be stupid? There's no reason to be stupid. It takes me off that we got people that read an article written by somebody who you don't know what kind of intention, what kind of agenda he's got, and they just eat it hook, line, and sinker, and they didn't even bother to go look for the original source of the article.
Can you give me an example?
In your backyard, we have the case of Hyatt versus North Carolina. Now, the narrative, you go to the articles, and oh my God, you know, the cops, now the Supreme Court has said that the cops can lie about a law and search your car. And there goes the Fourth Amendment. We are doomed.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. Yeah, isn't it terrible?
Yeah, except it doesn't. It didn't happen that way. The whole issue is simple. This guy, Hyen, got pulled over by the cops. He had a faulty brake light. He got pulled over. The cops got out. The whole scene. And allegedly, if you read the stuff, the guy went and searched his vehicle. They found cocaine. The problem is, according, supposedly the defense lawyer says that it's a law in North Carolina that says that as long as you have one brake light functioning, you're okay. So therefore, the whole thing that happened afterwards, the search and the arrest, the whole thing is illegal and had to be dumped.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But the Supreme Court said that no, even if he was mistaken, he had the right to do so and go search your car. Now, if you go and read the actual Supreme Court decision, you find out that, number one, there's one thing. There are conflicting statutes in the North Carolina law. One that says, yes, you need to have one light operating, but at the same time, there's another one that says all vehicles must have all brake lights in operating condition. So maybe it was some legislature mess up, but who knows? You know, there is enough doubt to say that the cop did the stop in good faith. But that's not all. Okay, he pulled over the car. He checked the paperwork on the guy, and everything was okay. He was going to issue a citation, and he noticed that there were two individuals in the car. They were acting kind of funky, and the cop asked the driver if he could search his car. The driver said, "Yes, you can go ahead and search my car, ladies and gentlemen. Once you give consent to search, and they found something inside your car, you are screwed." But how the hell did we make the jump from the cop lying to we don't have any Fourth Amendment rights anymore? I don't get it. We have this person from Slate, Dahlia Lithwick.
The Supreme Court ignores the lessons of Ferguson.
Dun, dun, dun.
This decision barely even acknowledges that by giving police officers license going forward to claim that they were confused about this law or that law, there will be even more distrust and error. It is unclear, based on the majority opinion and the concurrence of Justice Elena Kagan, how much more actual confusion will be infused into daily policing. Time will tell, I suppose. But the fact that police will now be likely encouraged to choose the broadest possible range of plausible readings of any traffic law seems like the worst possible outcome at the moment.
But, you know, if you think, okay, it's a slave, they are left-wing, they are kind of loonies, whatever. But no! Now we have Mark J. Fitzgibbons, an American thinker, which American thinker is not precisely, you know, a hotbed of communists and Che Guevara idol worshippers.
Lazy, incompetent bureaucrats will celebrate the Hein decision for years. The line from Chief Justice Roberts' majority opinion in the Hein case that pro-liberty folks just know will come back to haunt them like Freddy Krueger reads, "To be reasonable is not to be perfect, and so the Fourth Amendment allows for some mistakes on the part of government officials, giving them, quote, fair leeway for enforcing the law in the community's protection." Government lawyers right now are already smacking their lips, thinking that this line is license for incompetence far beyond the mistake of law made by the North Carolina police officer, and in more circumstances than just those involving the Fourth Amendment.
Godzilla! Both of them, okay? They are alleged journalists. They should know better. You know, go to the source. Go to the source. Don't just go repeating crap. And, you know, and like I said, this was a case of a good faith mistake. That's it.
It's not just professional journalists that do this. We do this in the gun community, too, don't we?
Oh, heck yeah. In my blog, I keep telling people, you know, just go ahead. Never depend on whatever anybody else says. Go ahead. Find the source. Read it. Read the law. Read the bill that's going to be passed. But, you know, be smart about it. Do not interpret the law at your convenience instead of being right. We have this gentleman here in the state of Florida who decides to reinterpret what is carried inside a vehicle. The Florida statutes say if you are in your vehicle, you can have a weapon without a concealed weapons permit as long as it is securely encased in a holster with a snap, inside the glove compartment, in a pouch with a zipper, in a case, a center console, no problem. So this guy is thinking, okay, I want to be super tactical. I am going to get a holster with a snap, and I'm going to screw it to my center console of my car. Wide open, plain view. I don't care what the police says. I am following the law. Except you're forgetting the other part of the statutes for the state of Florida, in which they say there is no such thing as open carry in the state of Florida.
So let's pay attention to all of the laws, not just the one law you know, want to deal with.
Not only that, you read the thread. People, oh, this is cool, you gotta do this, and I did this, and said, no, no, people, you're wrong, it's open carry, instead of doing stupid crap, why don't you help us pass open carry law? Basically, you know, when you read something, don't take it at face value, try to do as much research as possible. Find the real sources. And if you're not sure, go and look for people that know what they're talking about. Make sure that you interpret the law the way it's supposed to be interpreted, and not the way you want it to be interpreted, because, you know, hey, maybe you may be right, but maybe not. But that means you got to spend a lot of money on lawyers. Be smart about it. We had the info, use it.
All right, Miguel, it was good to talk to you. See you again next week.
Later.
Get more Miguel Gonzalez Daily at gunfreezone.net. Fun with headlines. Oh, you've got a good one for us today, don't you, Adam?
Yeah, this one is they could have done so much better with this headline. It would have been much more attention grabbing, but no. Driver who stopped for ducks gets jail, 10-year driving ban.
Holy crap, you know, there were like ducks in the road and she stopped?
Yeah.
And they took away her driver's license and put her in jail for 10 years? Do these people hate ducks? Somebody call weird.
I know, right? That's actually who I was thinking of when I came up with this one. No. So this article is actually really long, but I'm going to read the first couple of paragraphs. And this came from Canada. So
Canuckistan.
Canuckistan. The woman who stopped her car in the left lane of a Montreal area highway to herd ducklings to safety, which led to the death of a motorcyclist and his teenage daughter, will not spend the rest of her life in prison, Canadian media outlets report. Okay. So that's really the story, right? She parked her car in the middle of the interstate, or, you know, some
whatever
highway.
They call it in
yeah, whatever,
land.
Yeah, whatever they whatever it was up there.
The motorway?
The motorway, the freeway. Yeah, so she parks her car to protect the ducks, and a motorcyclist hit the back of her car with his 16-year-old daughter on the back, and they both died. So it's really driver who parked her car in the middle of the road doesn't get enough jail time for killing a father and his teenager.
That's not quite what the headline says.
Yeah. I mean, it goes from, oh, that sounds absurd. Why would you get jail for stopping for ducks? To, oh my gosh, why is she only getting 3 months in jail for killing two people?
Yeah. Yeah, moral of the story, ducks, not worth people's lives.
No.
Yeah, so one of the things my parents pointed out to me when I started driving is don't swerve around the animal and cause a 5-car pileup.
Yes.
Well, Barron talks about how the cops are using stingrays to hijack your cell phone and how one guy built his own for $1,500 on Tech Tips with the Barron. Barron, during some of the protests in Ferguson and I think in New York City, somebody posted a picture of what they said was a stingray. It was a car and it had some kind of cell phone catching device, and they said it was a stingray. What in the world is a stingray and how does it work?
So a stingray is known as an IMSI catcher. And so inside of your cell phone, you'll have a SIM card, which has a couple different serial numbers, the most important of which is the IMSI number, which basically identifies to the cell phone network who you are. So every person has their own IMSI number. The stingray works by pretending to be a cell tower, and you don't actually need a big, fat, you know, heavy-duty amplifier and antenna to pretend to be a cell phone tower, because power dissipates the further away it gets, and so the closer you are to the person that you're trying to intercept, the more likely the phone is to attach to you, because you will be the more powerful signal.
And cell phones are designed to work that way, right? Whatever cell phone tower is closer, that's the one it attaches to.
That is correct. Most cell phones have built an ability to run older protocols that are less secure. What happens is when you connect to the Stingray device goes, oh, I don't support all these new secure things. You're going to have to go and run unencrypted and do this, this, and this. And the phone goes, okay, I'm fine with that.
What exactly would law enforcement do with something like this?
Well, first and foremost, if they know exactly who it is they're looking for, and they can get the information from the cell phone company for the individual's IMSI number, they could actually go and track that individual and find him. But odds are that's not actually what they're doing from everything we've seen thus far. What they're really doing is trapping lots and lots of data and basically using it as a wiretap service.
Well, that would require them to have some sort of a warrant, don't you think?
I would think so, but evidently the law enforcement agencies don't think so.
Okay, so how expensive are these things?
Currently, we've heard numbers ranging from $16,000 to $125,000 for a Stingray or Stingray-type device. Stingray is actually a particular brand, but there's a couple different companies that make the same exact type of thing.
Okay, so that's a lot of money. That seems like, you know, you and I aren't going to go out and get one of these things and start, you know, stealing cell phone signals from our friends.
Yes. Yeah. The funny part about that is, well, like most things pertaining to the government's getting ripped off. Back in 2010, a guy by the name of Chris Padgett actually did a DEFCON presentation where he built for about $1,500 his own Stingray system. This was before Stingray was even a thing. Had it sitting there on a table and basically did a live demonstration where he started capturing people's phones inside the room and actually wiretapping them.
Like he could listen to their cell phone calls?
He could listen, record, and broadcast their cell phone conversations. It was absolutely hilarious.
That's pretty scary.
It is unbelievably scary, and the worst part about it is the majority of the problem that he was leveraging was the whole support for legacy protocols. We have, over time, protocols are made, they make things much easier to do because it's an established method of doing something. Well, when it comes to protocols relating to security, eventually over time you might, say, discover a vulnerability in the design of the protocol. So now you have a new problem. Protocol itself has a vulnerability. You really need to remove it from service, but if you remove it from service, a bunch of old legacy hardware or software may no longer work correctly. So you start running into this problem of, well, how long do I support this horribly dangerous item before I finally just look at everyone who's still using the horribly implemented old antiquated protocol and just say, you guys, you really just need to upgrade your crap. We're not dealing with you anymore.
So you said earlier that this device could tell my phone, hey, oh, you know, we can't use your fancy encryption or whatever it is you happen to have. Just shut all that off for me.
That is correct. That's exactly what it does.
So it sounds like my phone is the problem. If my phone was unable to go back to legacy protocols, then it would just reject any request to do so.
And that would be a fantastic way to solve the problem. And actually, I would be fine with me being able to tell my phone, hey, if you see any of this crap, don't connect to it. Just chuck it off to the side. I will deal with not having cell phone service.
Well, I see that.
You actually see this not just in the cell phone realm. This has actually become very apparent in the web services realm as of late. So there's a vulnerability called Poodle, and it's actually an exploit inside of the design of the SSL V3 protocol, if I remember correctly. It's an old protocol. You only really see it in Internet Explorer 6 and old Windows XP. And it's mainly stayed around to try and continue to support old legacy computers that people haven't upgraded for whatever reason. And I look at this and go, this thing's a glaring vulnerability and it should just be freaking taken out back and shot like old Yeller.
What we've got here is a problem of trying to be nice to people who have older, unupgraded systems and in the process leaving a giant hole in your security.
That is exactly right.
All right, Baron, it was good to talk to you. See you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
Baron still blogs at the-minuteman.org.
So Uncle, who blogs over at saysuncle.com, this last week posted a link to a thread on ar15.com about how you can make your own suppressor for $100. Now, obviously, you have to fill out your Form 1 with the ATF first.
Form 1 would be a ATF license permission tax stamp to build.
To make a
to
silencer.
To make an NFA item, whether that's a suppressor or a short barrel rifle.
Right.
It's not a buy it from somebody else. That would be a Form 4, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And you would have to do that before you even buy the materials. You have to wait for it to come back. Now, with an e-form, it takes now, they're saying 30 to 35 days.
Yeah, e-form ones are pretty quick now.
Yeah. So, but there's this company that sells, air quotes, solvent traps that you can basically buy that, and it's the suppressor body and the end caps. And then you can make your own baffles, basically using freeze plugs and some tools for a lathe. I don't really understand it a whole lot. I haven't delved terribly deeply into it, but at the end of it, you've got a 30 caliber suppressor for $100. Well, 300 if you add the tax stamp. So my 30 cal suppressor that I've got, that's made out of stainless steel, it's a Yankee Hill, I bought used for $400. So I'm thinking, maybe I should just do this. That'd be kind of neat.
Yeah, what most people don't understand is suppressors are really not that difficult to understand. They're not that complicated. It's just a muffler for your gun.
Yeah.
It's... You know, the only difference between that and a muffler is that you have to have a hole all the way through it.
Right.
Now, the materials cost is really not that much. Having seen somebody build one, I think you'd be better served by getting access to a lathe and to a Bridgeport machine and just building one out of bar stock and tubing and threading it and all that other happy stuff that you got to do. Any competent machinist could make a suppressor. I've hung out with a guy named Bob, the guy that built my rifle. It's a Templar Custom. Absolutely, if you want a really great AR-15, Templar Custom, great guy. I've watched him build suppressors. They're not that complicated. It's a lot of machining, but anybody who's reasonably competent with the machine tools can figure it out. Fill out your paperwork. You can make your own suppressor. The materials costs are not all that high. The question you have to ask yourself before you do that is why are you building the suppressor? Are you building a suppressor yourself to save money, or are you building it because you want a project? Do you go to IKEA and buy furniture because you want to save money, or do you go to IKEA and buy furniture because you want a project, you want to build your furniture? And if you're going there to save money, you're wasting your time.
Right.
But if you're going there because you want to have some fun and put some furniture together, hey, there you go. And that's the thing right there. How much is your time worth? How much do you pay yourself per hour? Because if you put 10 hours of labor and you want to pay yourself $10 an hour, there's $100. Now, you're going to put 40 hours of labor into the suppressor. You know, you're going to put some time into it. So do you want a project or do you want a suppressor?
So for me, since I already have two suppressors, this is really more kind of a project and I want to see how good it's going to be because, you know, I don't think that with the materials that these guys are making them with, these guys on the AR15.com thread, I don't really think they're going to last all that long. So one of the things when I bought my first suppressor that I covered was in New Zealand, you can buy a 22 suppressor for like $30 at the hardware store and they're made out of like polyurethane and, you know, they last maybe 50 to 100 rounds because you don't have to go through an arduous background check and a $200 tax stamp every time you buy one.
Right.
So the reason why we our suppressors here are so expensive is because they have to last, you know, 30, 40 years.
Yeah, they do. I am actually in the process of getting a suppressor. I should have one in the next month or two. I don't know how long it'll take.
And this is your first NFA item?
Yes. It's a Dakota Silencer 308 caliber suppressor. It'll go on my AR-15, but it'll also be good enough for me to put on a 300 blackout. It's actually rated all the way up to 300 Win Mag.
Yeah, the one that I've got, I bought, you know, for that same reason. When I bought it, I only had a 223.
Yeah. Now, I'm getting mine from ncsilencer.com. And North Carolina residents, if you want a silencer, you want an NFA item, absolutely go to ncsilencer.com. They're really great people, real sensible attitude. They will not sell you something that you don't need. You know, everybody wants a mount. You know, you want the, what do you call it?
The quick detach multi-mount.
Yeah, everybody wants
51T.
Quick detach mount. And you know what? You want to spend an extra $150 for a feature you will not use? Yeah, go ahead and do that. But you know, your rifle barrel has to be threaded to put that mount on. Well, just thread the suppressor to it. Save yourself the hassle.
Yeah.
And that's what they'll tell you. They'll be like, look, you know, we will sell you this really expensive surefire suppressor if that's what you really want. If you insist on spending that much money, we'll sell it to you. But if you really want something that works and doesn't break the bank, we'll sell you this. So ncsilencer.com, absolutely great people. But if you do want a project, let us know how it turns out. And Adam, if you make one, I want to see it.
Yeah, I think I'm going to look into it this weekend. I may submit my Form 1 this weekend. We'll see.
Okay, cool.
I was going to buy a winch, but, you know, this might be a better project.
Might be more fun.
Yeah, might get more use out of it.
Well, all right. Well, this week, Weird offers an epilogue to his gun death series. He talks about accidental deaths and defensive gun uses.
In This Week in Anti-Gun Nuttery.
So, Weird, last week I introduced your segment as the last in your gun death series. Now you're telling me there's more to the story?
We kind of got discussing after the show, and I felt like we needed to do a little bit of an epilogue.
All right. What do you want to talk about?
Well, you are asking me about accidents and accidental gun deaths.
All right, so tell me about accidents.
They don't happen.
What do you mean they don't happen?
Of course they do happen. I'm not denying reality, but let's face it. You live in a world that has cars, there's going to be automobile accidents. You live in a place where doctors prescribe drugs that might have a deadly effect, there's going to be accidental overdoses and people are going to die. Bad things are going to happen. If you've got a clothes dryer, someone's going to put their kid in it. So that does happen, but it's going to happen to a point where it's statistical noise. It just doesn't happen in any realistic sense of the word.
You showed me some numbers you got off of Whiskars, the CDC's numbers, and it just shows this continuous steady decline. And that's, you know, the recent numbers by the government. And you're also showing me, what is it I'm looking at here?
This is a report commissioned by the National Shooting Sports Foundation, and they go back as far as 1951 and show the number of unintentional firearms deaths, and it goes all the way up to 2000. I wish it went a little further, but this was the most conclusive thing that I can find, and it just shows that they are at a rapid decline.
It's interesting that this is raw numbers. This is actual dead bodies. This is not the percentage out of a population. The actual number is declining, even though we know the population of the United States is still growing. So that means that fewer and fewer as a percentage are dying as well.
That's right. And also there's more people that own guns and there's more firearms out in the wild. So yeah, I mean, we're approaching what could be considered a threshold for the amount of people that will accidentally die of firearms.
Well, that's certainly good news.
It's very good news.
Anything else you want to talk about?
Another thing I wanted to talk about with the gun death issue isn't directly tied to it, but I feel like it bookends it very, very nicely, and that's defensive gun use. And so we've got a whole bunch of studies out there, and the numbers are pretty wild depending on how they collect the numbers. Some have claimed as much as 2 million or 1 million numbers of defensive gun uses used every year. And I've got to say, I'm a little skeptical on these numbers. I think they're a little bit higher than should be because there's not really any way of verifying the veracity of the claims. So there are much more concrete studies that show defensive gun uses around 100,000 per year. And there are a few studies that show defensive gun uses below the rate of gun crime, but those studies are also generally directly linked to the anti-gun lobbies. And studies have best shown that if you're in a violent encounter, having a gun is the best way to avoid serious harm. So
wait a minute, Weird. We know the number of people, relatively speaking, who are shot dead in defensive gun uses. And that number is really, really small.
That is absolutely true. And that's another very interesting statistic is the studies have shown that 91.1% of all defensive firearm uses ends with no shots being fired. Overall, this is a very good thing. It's saying that defensive gun use isn't necessarily meaning more gun death, whether you want to call it good gun death or bad gun death. It generally just means less violence.
But Weird. We all know that the minute the economy turns down, we're going to have a surge in violence, a surge in crime, and all this is going to be wiped away in a second. We're just going to repeat the 60s, right?
Well, historically, that does appear to be true, is that when the economy takes a downturn, violent crime tends to go up as people become unemployed and more desperate for money. But we're towards the tail end of a pretty bad recession, and violent crime continued to go down throughout it as more people bought firearms.
So what you're saying is more guns? Well, we're not really sure that it causes less crime, but we can certainly say that more guns doesn't equal more crime.
It would be impossible for that to be happening.
All right. Well, that's certainly good news, Weird. It was good to talk to you. I'll see you again next week.
All right. Talk to you later, Sean.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host at The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. Stuff that grinds my gears. Now, I have driven to my parents' house. It's a 10-hour drive one way twice in the last 30 days.
You must really love your parents.
Well, I do. I do.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, I have put 50,000 miles on the 2014 Chevy Malibu since I got it in October of last year.
So that thing's worth like $300 now.
Something like that. It's a beautiful car. 50,000 miles. It's very nice. So I maintain it properly.
Good, good.
People who cannot maintain a steady speed on the highway.
Oh my God, I hate that guy.
Come on, guys. Cruise control is pretty much standard. Set the cruise control 5 miles an hour faster than whatever the speed limit says. Get in your lane and stop this garbage. Because, you know, what happens is, oh, you think you're good at this, maintaining the steady speed. Oh, yeah, I'm a great driver. No, you're not. You suck. Trust me, I'm driving next to you. I know this. I drive down the road. I guarantee you I am not changing speed because my cruise control is set. Zoom down the road I go, and I pull up next to you, and what do? You moron, you push on the gas pedal. You don't think you're pushing on the gas pedal, but you are. Oh, yeah. Yes, you are.
It's completely subconscious.
And you're like, oh, I can't let him pass me, or I don't know what's going on in your head, but you have gone and just blocked me in the left-hand lane. And I don't want to be in the left-hand lane because idiot that wants to do 20 over the speed limit is fast coming up on my backside, and I want to let him through because, you know, people who want to drive like that are really not the people you want right behind you because they generally have poor impulse control to go with their poor judgment. So don't want that action. I just want to be out of the way. And what do? You block me out there, you moron. Set the cruise control. You are not as good of a driver as you think you are.
So when I used to live in Mississippi and would drive to back to Nashville, that was about a 300-mile trip or so for me. And I would run into that all the time. It got so bad that I wanted to like put some sort of display in my back window that showed my actual speed. You know, it's like my speed, you know, 73. What's yours? because you would get, you know, okay, you'd be, you know, you're going cruise control, go, go, go. You pass somebody who's going, you know, 50 in a 70.
Yeah. Right?
And then 3 minutes later, he's passing you going 85. And then 2 minutes after that, you pass him again and he's going 50.
Yeah. Like, and see, those are the egregious ones. And those you just sort of like you can laugh off because they're every once in a while you see him. It's the guy that wants to do 5 miles an hour slower than you and then 5 miles an hour faster than you. And he never gets more than 10 car lengths away.
Oh, yeah.
Those are the annoying ones.
I actually have gotten off the interstate and just gone to go get gas just to get away from that guy.
You know, and if concealed handgun permit holders were as violent as the anti-gunner said, there'd be a trail of dead bodies behind me for just that reason. Please, your cruise control works. It was put there because clearly you are not the driver you think you are. Use it. Put it 5 miles an hour over the speed limit. You will get to your destination faster than anything else you could have done. You'll never again worry about a ticket from the police officer. In fact, you can wave at the cops as you go by, and they'll wave back at you, because five over the speed limit is not worth the effort of pulling you over.
Not worth their time.
Mm-mm. They've got idiots out there doing 20 over the speed limit and then tailgating. So yeah, they're going to pull him over. They're not going to pull you. Cruise control.
Cruise control.
Love it.
Use it.
Learn it. Use it. All right, Adam, what's pissing you off this week?
So let's talk about AT&T Wireless again.
Oh, no.
So
you want to hug these people with a rope, don't you? Well, around their necks.
Okay, so this one is not their fault, right?
Okay.
So 15 years ago, I got mobile data, unlimited mobile data for like $7 a month.
Uh-huh.
It was fantastic.
Yeah.
Then they throttled me and I switched over to a plan that was like, I don't know, 5 gigs of data a month or something.
That's a pretty good size.
And then, yeah. And then they started to throttle again after you did two gigs of data or whatever. And I went mostly to Wi-Fi after that. Well, when we signed up for this new plan, you could have 2 gigs or 4 gigs or 10 gigs, you know, all this data. Well, I looked at the amount of data that I used in the last year and the amount of data that my wife used over the last year. And we never combined went over 2 gigs.
Right. Okay.
So I'm like, okay, all right, cool. So I'm going to, you know, get 2 gigs of mobile data and we'll share it between us and, you know, we'll save us some money. So I have an Android.
Right.
And Google really wants you to sign up for Google Plus.
Yeah. You basically can't do anything if you're not a Google Plus.
Right. Right.
I mean, it's like your entryway to everything.
Yeah. So when you set up your phone, it asks you if you want to automatically upload your pictures and videos to Google Plus, but I don't actually think it mentions Google Plus. It just says, do you want to save those in the cloud? Like, well, yeah, you know, of course I do. Yeah. So what I didn't know was that it was actually going to upload all my videos over 4G, even when I told it not to, or rather, even though I didn't tell it that it should do that. So what happened was I was at the Christmas party for the company, and there was some karaoke, and I took some video on my 16 megapixel 1080p camera phone, and I used 890 megs
in one night. That's not a data overage. That's completely insane.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so you're taking out a second mortgage on your house and you're calling Dave Ramsey.
Oh, geez. So I have to go and look, but I'm pretty sure that I can buy another gig of data for like $10. I don't think it's as bad as it used to be.
Oh, where... wait a second. You're saying those are megabytes, not gigabytes.
Yes, megabytes. Oh, God. Oh, good Lord. 890 gigabytes would be...
No.
But I only
down
took
from the ledge.
But I only took 6 minutes of video.
Yeah. Okay. So you use half your monthly data in one night.
I used half of the monthly data between me and my wife in one night. Yeah. So I didn't actually know that had happened until the next day. I think I actually like hit the wrong button on the phone and it brought up my data usage statistics and it gives you a nice little graph of how much data you used over the month. And then it was like, you know, waterfall.
Yeah. Wow.
And it was like, oh yeah, all this is coming from Google Plus. And I'm like, what is going on here? So I open up Google Plus and I had never opened it before. That was the thing that really got me, because I got the whole, hey, congratulations. You know, here's how you use Google Plus. I'm like, settings, don't upload over 4G, just upload over Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
For the videos.
When I had unlimited data and I was using an Android phone, I listened to a whole lot of Pandora Radio. And Pandora Radio eats your data.
Oh, yeah.
I would consistently go just a bit over 2 gigs a month between Pandora and, of course, since I drive everywhere, I'm using Google Maps.
Right, right.
That was me killing the data at 2 gigs, 2.3, 2.4 gigs a month.
I used to have to drive to Atlanta, and this is when I still had my unlimited data, and I would actually do tech TV podcasts.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I would use 9 gigs of data in a month.
Yeah, you kind of have to work at that, though.
Yeah, you really do have to work at that.
Well, that's our show for the week. Thanks again to Rob Allen for our music, and thank you for listening to the Gunblog Variety Cast. Constructive criticism can be sent to Sean at SeanSorrentino.com and hate mail to WizardPC at GunsCarsTech.com. Show notes can be found at GunblogVarietyCast.com/episode18. Felons behaving badly. Man starved death to dog on purpose. Wake deputies charged.
Say that again.
All right. What do you want to talk about?
Well, you are asking me about accidents and accidental gun deaths.
All right. So tell me about accidents.
They don't happen.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll just skip that segment. What else you want to talk about?
What do we do talking before that? No,
all right.
If you could give them a little bit more.
What do you mean they don't happen?